Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. All right, we have one case for scheduled for argument on the 10:30 docket. We'll call that now. Stephen Ray Smith versus the State of Texas. Ms. Walker?
My name is Pamela Walker, and I represent Stephen Smith, and this is my first opportunity to be before Court of Appeals. In this case, the issue, I believe, is fairly simple in that it involved a theft over $100,000, under $200,000. Mr. Smith was found guilty by the jury and sentenced to 99 years. In addition to the theft charge, he was also charged with felon in possession of a gun and possession of methamphetamine, both of which the jury found him not guilty. During the course of the trial, a co-indictee testified against the appellant. This would be Mr. Scotty Elmore. He is an accomplice as a matter of law, and the state has conceded such in its reply brief to my appellant brief. So I'm not sure if the court wished to go into that in any detail, since we all seem to be in agreement on that part. Mr. Elmore was, in fact, the self-admitted thief in the three thefts that occurred, and it was his contention that my client was also involved. The trial proceeded. At the end of the trial, there was no accomplice witness charge given to the jury, which, given the status of Mr. Elmore being a co-indictee as a matter of law and accomplice, it was, as some of the cases have cited, glaring error for that to have not been submitted to the jury as part of the jury charge, and it was not requested by the appellant's court-appointed attorney, Terrence Russell, or done by the court itself, sua sponte. So
I think that point's conceded, is it not, by the state?
That is.
Yeah.
With respect to one point I would like to make, I have done a great deal of research into this matter. If an objection is lodged to the failure of the court to put that instruction in the jury charge, then the appellant is afforded the right to have an appellate review on a some harm fashion. If there is no objection made, then it requires egregious error, along with, of course, other things, for the appellant to be able to succeed at the level of the Court of Appeals. In this particular case, my client's court-appointed lawyer just failed to request it. It was never even mentioned at all. And it seems that my client is being further prejudiced in his right to a fair and impartial trial by being forced to show egregious error, in addition to the case law establishing the tends to connect requirement, which is a low hurdle for the state to achieve, really makes the appellant at a severe disadvantage. And I would at least like to make that point, that in this case, there was nothing my client could have done in this case. He was relying on counsel. With respect to the tends to connect, would you like me to go briefly into the facts of the case, or?
It's up to you, counsel. I mean, we're going to read the record anyway.
Okay.
We never complain about an attorney giving us time back.
Okay.
That's what you'd like to do.
Well, because in this case, I'd like to just go to the tends to connect evidence presented by the state, wherein the state claims there is enough tends to connect evidence even without the co-indictee accomplice's testimony to connect my client to this crime. He was charged specifically with and indicted for theft and not possession of stolen property, not fencing stolen property, nothing like that. He was charged with these three separate thefts. And Mr. Elmore's testimony, he admitted the defendant wasn't there, had nothing to do with the actual thefts themselves. The state is claiming tends to connect evidence through, first of all, the testimony of Sergeant Smith, who was the initial investigating officer at the scene, where the appellant admitted, I'm co-owner of this Hood County property out here. He never paid a dime, never had anything to do with the paperwork in the purchase of the property. His sole reason for any involvement in this property was his hobby of working on old cars, where he had, depending on certain time periods, anywhere from 5 to 20 old cars that he worked on. And this is a man who couldn't drive due to his criminal history. He needed a place to store those cars. He lived in Haltom City, where he rented a garage apartment from a very nice old lady who said, the city's complaining. You've got to do something about these cars. Elmore says, I need work on this trailer. If you'll work on my trailer, you can park your cars out here. And that's exactly what he did. He was out there 3 weekends doing repair work on the trailer, attempting to get it habitable. And he was out there, according to his own testimony, once or twice after work during the week, getting his cars hauled out there. That was it. During the course of the time out there, he was busy, per his own testimony, working on the trailer. The police officer stated when he got there, upon his arrival, Mr. Smith was working on the trailer, appeared to be doing remodeling, and was outside the trailer. So I don't believe that point is in dispute. The co-ownership of the property in and of itself is not sufficient to find any property contained on that property, be it stolen or otherwise, is his responsibility. He was only out there on rare occasions, and that's not what he was out there for. He was out there to work on his cars and work on the trailer. So I don't believe Sergeant Smith's testimony is sufficient to connect Mr. Smith to the thefts. Then we've got three individuals, Susan Elmore, Carol Schott, well, these two specific individuals who received correspondence or communicated with the defendant while he was in jail, which Mr. Smith addressed during his testimony during the trial. Susan Elmore contends that the defendant called her and suggested to her if her son, who was the main perpetrator, would accept the full rap for these crimes, that my client would help him out financially. Mr. Smith denied that conversation, and again, his contention is Elmore was the one responsible for this. Why wouldn't he accept responsibility? You can tell from the transcript, though, his telephone conversation was something about Elmore's belongings and his belongings, but he was never afforded the opportunity to really expound upon that. Carol Schott, who sold the property to Mr. Elmore, who was the sole individual handling the negotiations, completing the paperwork, all he did was take the paperwork to Mr. Smith and say, sign here, which he did. And what my client testified was, and which makes sense, I was asking her, I wasn't involved in the negotiations. All I did was sign as to be co-owner, and his contention was, Mr. Elmore's contention was, that way if anything happens to me, you'll still have a place to put your car. If when you read the transcript, I hope you will be able to tell Mr. Smith is of limited education, and I believe he genuinely thought, I'm protected. If I'm co-owner, it's not costing me a dime other than to take care of the trailer, and I've got a place to take care of my cars. And there is testimony by numerous witnesses. He does have an incredible hobby with these old cars. Likes to buy them, a few hundred dollars, refurbish them, and that's what he likes to do when he's not working. So his contention is with Ms. Schott, that's all he wanted, was for her to say, I never saw the guy. I didn't know him. He wasn't involved with the negotiations. I don't know his involvement specifically with the property other than his name was on the document. Then we've got a neighbor, Clinton Sullivan, who lived some distance away, although it states next door, but out in Granbury, Hood County. Next door is not a Fort Worth next door. There's some distance between the properties, who testified that he saw Mr. Smith working on a dually pickup that was stolen in one of the business burglaries, working on the truck, grinding off decals at night, 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. It was very questionable whether or not he actually could possibly have seen what it was he said he saw. Now, he did state that Mr. Smith was riding a stolen ATV, a Gator ATV, that was taken in one of the three robberies. But Mr. Smith was told by Mr. Elmore, if you want to ride it while you're out here to go to the store because he couldn't drive, feel free to do so. And he did. He didn't try to hide it, didn't try to sneak around anything. And he did meet Mr. Sullivan on the date of his arrest, and they discussed gravel. So Mr. Sullivan had an eye-to-eye conversation with him. There was another neighbor out there who admitted he saw people out there at all hours of the night, but he could not identify Mr. Smith as one of those individuals. So we've got Mr. Smith on an ATV for sure, who he testifies, and Mr. Elmore also testified, sure, I told him he could ride the ATVs out there whenever he was out there. Unbeknownst to Mr. Smith, he didn't know the ATV was stolen. Last but not least, we have Lisa Atkins, sometimes girlfriend of Mr. Smith, 19-year friend of Mr. Smith, who potentially could be considered an accomplice in this entire situation by the DA's own testimony or statement during his cross-examination of Ms. Atkins, where he states that, so you have found out that you might be involved in this, that you might be a player in all this, and you're concerned about that. And she stated yes, which automatically should make her testimony somewhat suspect as even a potential accomplice. There was written communications back and forth between Mr. Smith and Ms. Atkins, who admitted on the stand to having stolen at least 200 cars. She had quite a history. And she was looking at a potential 99-year prison sentence herself and admitted she was cooperating with the DA in her understanding for consideration on a sentence, though no number had been discussed. That is the sum and substance of the tends to connect evidence. Nothing. Now, Ms. Atkins, who is a possible accomplice, does state, I sold or gave Steve some stolen items. Some stolen items. Doesn't say exactly when, and it doesn't say what items to which she's referring. Were these the items from the three burglaries in question, which that was never stated? From that point, there is not one single piece of evidence that puts any of this material, stolen property, stolen vehicles, in Mr. Smith's control. He was out at the land, yes. All this property was out at the land, yes. But he was not doing anything but working on the trailer. And this is guilt by presence, nothing more. And if they had anything else, this was a two-day trial. We would have seen it. There would have been something. The majority of this case was taken up with the victims. Nobody disputes the thefts and the items taken and the number of items taken.
Counsel, your time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Casper.
May it please the court. Chief Justice Casey, Justice Livingston, and Justice Holman. My name is Lori Casper, and I'm representing Hood County, the state of Texas, in this case. I'm going to dispense with question one, which is whether it was error for the trial court to not include the witness instruction, because we've already conceded that point, and move to point two, whether the appellant suffered egregious harm as a result of this failure to include this instruction. And the state contends that no, the appellant did not suffer egregious harm. Under the standard set forth in Solis v. State, the harm has to be such that the appellant did not receive a fair and impartial trial. There was sufficient corroborating evidence, as opposed to what appellant's counsel states, to show that this appellant was fencing stolen property. Fencing is one of the definitions of theft. He exercised control over the stolen property, as stated in the jury instructions. Number three, whether the appellant's attorney rendered ineffective assistance of counsel is the third issue for failing to request this instruction, and the state contends that no, there was no ineffective assistance of counsel because the failure, that there was no egregious harm, it was a harmless error to not include this, and if there's a harmless error, then there can't be ineffective assistance of counsel. Appellant cannot show that he can overcome the presumption that appellant's counsel acted rationally and acted professionally and was effective. He cannot show that but for the actions of counsel that the outcome of this trial would have been different. Under Solis v. State, we talk about the tends to connect between any other kind of evidence that would tend to corroborate what the accomplice said, and it should make a fact more likely than not that it's true. Under Reed v. State, the Court of Criminal Appeals also talked about that tends to connect. It's a very low hurdle for the state, fortunately for our side, that we have to meet in order to corroborate. And the state will put forth that virtually all of the accomplice's testimony was corroborated in some way. It tended to connect the appellant. And it was corroborated through state's witnesses and defense witnesses. In particular, accomplice Elmore said that he met the appellant through a mutual prison friend. That was corroborated by the appellant himself. Appellant was aware that his accomplice had no job and had a criminal history of being a thief, a convicted thief. Number two, the accomplice testified that he had sold stolen equipment in the past to the appellant. Appellant had acted as a fence for him on other occasions. Lisa Atkins, a witness for the prosecution, testified that she had also used appellant as a fence for other crimes in the past, other thefts in the past. Number three, accomplice Elmore said that appellant had bought stolen equipment with drug money. Lisa Atkins corroborated that, saying that she had often bought drugs from the appellant. In fact, appellant had a conviction for delivery of methamphetamine. Accomplice Elmore said that he and appellant were co-owners of the property in Hood County. There's no doubt that they were co-owners. They both executed the document. They both signed it. In fact, when Sergeant Smith approached appellant on the property, he said, "I am a co-owner of this property." Appellant Carol Schott testified, and again, you know, appellant testified that this is not true. Carol Schott testified that it was, and it's up to the jury to judge the demeanor and the credibility of the witnesses. Carol Schott, the original owner of the property, said that both appellant and the accomplice filled out the paperwork and that the appellant had contacted her from jail and told her to lie to the district attorney and tell the district attorney that he had no part in the purchase of that property and he was not a co-owner. The jury could have found that to be damaging evidence towards the appellant and to corroborate what accomplice Elmore had said. Accomplice Elmore said that appellant did exercise control over the property and was a fence for the property. Clinton Sullivan, that's probably the most damaging evidence in total to the appellant. Clinton Sullivan, the next-door neighbor, said he saw the appellant grinding the identification decals off the side of the black pickup truck, which was later found abandoned on another property. The keys to that black pickup truck were found near the place where appellant stayed in the accomplice's trailer. That is a tense to connect the appellant to this crime of fencing stolen property. Coupled with the fact that appellant knew that his accomplice, Scotty Elmore, was a convicted thief and had done this before, has to have known that by grinding off the numbers off the side of the pickup truck and taking possession of one of the Gator ATVs, which Scotty Elmore said he sold to the appellant, and driving that to the convenience store, indicates that he had control. He was exercising control over the property. Defense witness Ewing said that he saw the Gator on the property, he saw the truck on the property, and he saw a number of cars on the property, which Clinton Sullivan said he saw appellant chopping up. Chopping up is different from refurbishing old cars. Chopping up indicates that you're taking property and you're taking it apart because it's stolen property and you're going to sell the pieces of it. Witness Ewing also testified that he saw many unusual tools on the property. They were laying everywhere. Those tools were specialized tools that were used in maintaining electrical lines. And Witness Ewing said that anybody would have known that those are not the kind of tools that you use in fixing up a trailer. Susan Elmore, the mother of the accomplice, said that appellant called her and said if Scotty, the accomplice, would take complete blame for it, that he would help him out in prison by giving him money. Again, it's up to the jury to decide what kind of connection they can make between that, but that definitely sounds like it's corroborating evidence. Accomplice Elmore said that he sold appellant trailers, a four-wheeler, and tools, and some of those were found at the Hood County location. The only piece of evidence that the accomplice provided that was not corroborated was the evidence, the testimony, appellant said that accomplice said that appellant slept on a couch in the travel trailer where the methamphetamine and the firearm were found. That is the only piece of evidence, testimony, that was not corroborated by other witnesses. And it's very telling that the jury took this into consideration and actually found the appellant not guilty of the possession of the firearm and the possession of the methamphetamine. That is the only piece that was not corroborated. They did find him guilty, however, of exercising control over that stolen property based on what the other witnesses had said. This court said in Jones v. State that if there is non-accomplice evidence that connects the appellant to the offense, then the failure to add the instruction was harmless. That's exactly what we have in this case. The failure to add that instruction was harmless. And as such, if the failure to add that instruction was harmless, there cannot be ineffective assistance of counsel because of a harmless error. The only error that appellant has alleged that counsel made in the entire trial proceeding was the fact that he did not request the accomplice witness instruction. And again, if the corroborating evidence is such that error was harmless, then there is no ineffective assistance of counsel. Accordingly, the state would ask this court to find that the court's failure to add that accomplice witness instruction was harmless, that the court's that the defendant's counsel was not ineffective for the failure to request that instruction, and we ask that you affirm the judgment of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
In this particular case, I can't imagine anything other than egregious harm being demonstrated by what took place during this trial. Mr. Smith was not afforded a fair and impartial trial, given the jury's absence of any kind of instruction with respect to the accomplice and the involvement of an accomplice. If the state looks at it one way, I look at it another. The not guilty on the drug and gun charge to me indicates that there were some issues or some questions that the accumulation of evidence perhaps would not have been sufficient had the jury been properly charged in this case. For example, on Carol Schott's testimony, this letter where she claimed and testified, he asked me to lie, and I was angry about that. Go to the DA. And this is an educated, intelligent woman. She couldn't produce the letter. She said, I threw it away. I didn't want it. And that, to me, raises a question of the validity of her statement versus Smith saying, I just wanted you to know, I wouldn't tell him. I was never there. I never talked to you about this, which is what he claimed. With respect to Sullivan, chopping up cars, I don't know exactly what's involved with chopping up cars, but I can't help but think working on cars would also be something that someone feasibly could say, hey, he was chopping up cars, which, again, if with the layout of the system, of the land, it's very questionable as to what he saw at 11:30 at night, full moon or not. With respect to Jones v. State, and that was by this court, if you'll recall, that involved the defendant was the driver of the vehicle, evading police, and throwing out smoking items being used to make methamphetamine. I don't believe that evidence was quite strong to connect, especially with the police watching. That was not the case here. The tends to connect is weak at best, and no one puts possession control, exercising possession of control, directly on Mr. Smith of any of these items. Even if you want to believe he was doing what Elmore said, and grinding anything off a dually pickup, which he specifically denies ever having even seen that pickup. So in this case, we would ask you to please look at this evidence, the tends to connect evidence. Look at the possibility that Lisa Atkins' testimony shouldn't have been considered at all. And we believe there was egregious error, and it should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you both for appearing here this morning and present your arguments. The case is submitted, and we'll ask the clerk to adjourn us for the day.